Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Cash and Carry Kitchens. Transform your home with the warmth of an Irish-made kitchen. Cashandcarrykitchens.ie.
Email todaycb at rte.ie.
Now, earlier this month, when the Irish government signed an extradition agreement with the United Arab Emirates, the former Assistant Garda Commissioner John O'Driscoll was hailed as the man who set the wheels in motion leading to the deal, which will likely further erode the power of the Kinahan organised crime group. Well, very sadly, John died unexpectedly last month, just before he was due to publish his memoir, which is called On Duty: Reflections on a Life in the Guards. Well, today, John's brother, Donal O'Driscoll, is here with me tomorrow, mark the publication of the book and to remember his brother. Donal, it's lovely to have you with us, and my condolences to you and to the family. I'm sure you're all still dealing with the shock of losing John.
We are, Claire, and thank you very much for having me on. It's a big shock. It's my first personal experience of the sudden death of a close relative, and anyone who's experienced it knows what a traumatic event it is, and however bad it is for myself and our family, you know, his wife Muriel and his own family. You know, you don't expect when someone leaves the house of a day, not to see them again.
I mean, and we had planned to have John in here to talk about his book. Yeah. I mean, it happened so suddenly, but it is so poignant that he had put this together and it was ready to go. And he was really looking forward to talking about the book and his life in the Guards, wasn't he?
He was. He was absolutely thrilled to have it finished. He was really very much looking forward to what was coming next. In the 2 years since he retired, that's what he'd spent his time doing. And so he was very excited. I had a pint with him a couple of nights before he died, and that's what we talked about, you know.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah, it's a shame that he's not here to see it, but it is a legacy. It's a nice legacy to
yeah. And we'll talk about his career in a moment. But I was really interested when I was thinking about him in that 2 years after he retired. Did he find it hard to fill his time, given the rate that he worked at and the level he was working at?
He says it in the book. He missed the interaction with people, he missed the energy and he missed the busyness. That's exactly what he says.
Mm-hmm.
He'd been a busy man. In fact, he was asked early on in his career by a colleague what his ambition was to be, and he said he wanted to be a busy policeman, and he certainly was that. So yeah, it's like a sudden death like that deprives you of the life that he would have led, the contributions that he could have made. The book engaged him. He had other plans and other things that he was looking at doing in terms of advising internationally.
Yeah.
And so I think, you know, he had an awful lot more to give. And I suppose realistically, one of the things he was very anxious about was that the book here, it isn't just a log of all the cases that he was involved in. It is that as well. And they're absolutely fascinating. And they're really diverse. And he had a very diverse career. But he also wanted the book to make a contribution to the discussion on policing and policing in the future. And I think it really succeeds in doing that as well. So it's got a lot going on in the book.
Well, let's talk a little bit about the background, because the life in public service that he led and that you led, because you were a member of the Guards yourself, I mean, that was the family business.
It was, I suppose, yeah. Yeah, my father was also a policeman. He was a guard in Store Street back. Actually, a nice little connection running through our service was that my father was based in Store Street in the 1940s. He joined, interestingly, a group called Antaka Shikana, which were a unique group. They were formed in 1939 at the outbreak of the war, of 400 officers. They were only temporary, a basis, and they were paid less than guards, serving guards. In 1942, they were subsumed into An Garda Síochána. He had served in Store Street, and when he was working in Store Street, single members were allowed to do at the time, were to avail of living accommodation, and he lived in Fitzgibbon Street Station in the city centre, North City Centre. And he lived there in 1941 when the Germans dropped the bombs on the North Strand. Mm-hmm. 40 years later, when John left Templemore, he went to Fitzgibbon Street Station, and he spent the first 10 years of his service there. And then about 3 years after that, I arrived there. And I served there for 3 years. So, yeah, we all walked the beat in the North Inner City. And the North Inner City was particularly close to John, who spent an awful lot of time in his career there.
But your father didn't want you to join the Guards, did he?
Well, it was more so with John. he got the brunt of it. Yeah, look, every parent wants better for their children. He joined in the 1930s, and he and my mother reared a family in the 1960s, 70s and 80s. And paying conditions were very poor in Garda Síochána before the Judge Conroy Commission in the 1974, I think it was. Pay was quite poor. I think when he joined, they were paid, I think, £2.10 a week. And they got one day off in a month, and they didn't. Someone else decided what day that was. So he wanted better. He wanted us all to go to college and get jobs in private industry, as he saw better paid and easier. And indeed, John, who did his Leaving Cert at the tender age of 16, by the way, had got a job in Texaco in Ball's Bridge, a well-paid job. And so he was sort of looking askance at John leaving a very well-paid job.
He did that for a number of years, didn't he, before he joined the Guards?
He did 4 years with Texaco, yeah.
Yeah, and then he decided to go into the hard and dangerous job of policing.
He was determined to follow my father. He had the privilege of serving with my father. I didn't. My father died shortly after he retired. But John had the first year and a half where the two of them served together. Mm-hmm. But he was determined to follow my father's footsteps.
So you mentioned the North Inner City, which plays a really big role, I know, in John's policing life. And at that time, the heroin epidemic, Donal, was a defining part of his career, would you say?
Well, absolutely. He'd policed the North Inner City for the first 10 years. He wasn't in an unseemly rush to be promoted. He wanted to learn his trade. He was promoted at his first taste of rural policing in Rathangan, but was back in the city a year later, serving as a community officer in Store Street, again back in the North Inner City, which he loved so much. At the time, Ireland was in the throes of a heroin epidemic and had been for over a decade, in the 80s into the 90s. The inner city was particularly badly affected. Unemployment was through the roof. People had very poor life chances from their birth. Young people were disaffected, disillusioned, and they were looking for an escape. And drug dealers were more than happy to provide that to them in the form of heroin.
But John had a very compassionate view of those people who were in the throes of addiction.
Well, very telling, and his approach was, drug addicts are victims. And they need more help and assistance and treatment. And at the time when he went back into the drugs unit, you know, on the face of it, the guards were being quite successful. They were seizing a lot of drugs, making a lot of arrests. But 80% of the drugs that were being seized was cannabis, and 20% only were Class A drugs such as heroin. And 80% of the people that were being arrested were users and addicts, and only about 20% were dealers. So his approach in looking at that, and the approach of the people that he worked with, excellent people he worked with in the North Division Drugs Unit, was to try and turn that around, because plainly the community could see with the drug dealers who were living and working within the community and living lavish, ostentatious lifestyles and dealing in debt, that they weren't being tackled. So the state looked kind of powerless and these people felt forgotten. So his approach and the approach of his colleagues in the drug unit was to turn that on its head and to look for, to target heroin, obviously, which was the big problem, the heroin dealers who were doing most of the damage. And by the time he left it years later, about 6 years later, it was the exact opposite. 70% of the people who were being arrested and dealt with, he often talked about it was quality rather than quantity. How the police measure success. Evaluate that carefully. Understand what success looks like. It isn't necessarily quantity over quality. And very
it's
importantly,
going after the big guys, isn't it?
Going after the big guys, and very importantly, the community and the police's definition of success and evaluation of success has to align. Mm-hmm. If the community sees that the police are ineffective and the rule of law is threatened, these people are literally see that crime pays. They see these dealers living with impunity in the community. So, yes, they went after it.
But he did a very simple thing. You know, I mean, he was dealing with an area where the Gardaí were seen as part of the problem, weren't they,
Absolutely.
Rather than the solution. But his idea was to speak to people with respect, treat people decently, and speak to them on your own level. Don't talk down to people. And it worked.
Oh, it absolutely worked. He established very early on in his career, he was very thoughtful about policy. I mean, he was interviewed very early on in his career by Stephen Ray, a colleague Stephen Ray, for the Garda Review back in 1981. And when he was asked what his ambition was, Stephen Ray said to him afterwards, most people said a rank, they wanted to achieve a role they wanted to play. Mm-hmm. He said he wanted to affect Garda policy and influence Garda policy. And he did a degree and early on in his career as well. And the subject of his dissertation was evaluating what success looked like for the police. And again, it was extremely important that it was effective and that it was aligned with the community's needs. And so he established that you needed to align your goals and objectives with the community. You needed to collaborate with the community. You needed to consult with the community, and you needed to communicate. As he said, he never turned down an invitation to speak anywhere to anybody. He didn't mind what people thought, and it was frowned upon at times, some of the people he spoke
with.
But again, he surrounded himself with capable, like-minded colleagues. They put a plan in place. They went after the dealers, and very importantly, they went after their assets.
Yeah, people
like...
this
was novel at the time.
Tony Filoni, Michael Cronin, Derek Dunn.
Yeah.
Seizing their assets and crippling them financially. That was the key to it, wasn't it?
Absolutely. In, what's their incentive? Their incentive is to make money, which gains them power. They have to have the wherewithal, the structures, the enterprise in place. His attitude was, go after these guys. Go after, dismantle their operations, identify, freeze and seize their assets. So, and get them long, go for quality prosecutions and convictions. Mm-hmm. For drug, not for possession, which was much easier to do, but for possession, for sale and supply, for dealing. Get them long sentences, and when they come out of prison, empty pockets, as he said, that there'd be nothing for them to come out to, and the wherewithal and the means to make the money was gone.
And the people that they were selling drugs to, he saw the value in sport for those people, and in particular in the inner city, boxing. He was a big fan of that, wasn't he?
He was a big fan of sport, personally. He was a rower when he was younger. He ran. In fact, sadly, he died doing something he loved, which was running. His family were onto sport. His son, Sean, is a talented track athlete. But realistically, he saw sport, the value of sport in terms of physical health, mental health and well-being, but also for the opportunities that it gives people, and particularly in deprived areas. You know, the life skills it can teach you, you know, discipline, constraint, respect, perseverance. And indeed, very importantly, look at the North Inner City, look at the amount of sporting heroes and boxing heroes mm-hmm. in particular. That yep. is, so it was particularly galling then to see the likes of the Kinnans take boxing and to use it for their own nefarious purposes, to rehabilitate their reputations, and to further exploit and damage and wash their ill-gotten gains through sport.
Now, I want to follow through on his career then, because it really does span a changing Ireland. So, and a big part of that is us going from a country of emigration to a desirable place for people to come and live and work. And that meant that the state had to, Donal, play catch up with regards to immigration itself. And John was right at the centre of that, wasn't he?
He was. Again, the breadth of his career was incredible. Like, right from crime across to, you know, drugs, special operations, but he was jumping into a completely new area when he went into immigration, and he was there at the foundation. I and myself had worked in the building where we dealt with aliens, as they were called back in the day, where there was only a handful of people coming in on a weekly basis. There was no waiting room, there was no facilities for them, and you know, I think it went from the mid 90s where there was something like 12,500 applications for aliens or as they were known as non-nationals.
Mm-hmm.
To apply to remain in the state. Within a couple of years, or about a decade, there was a queue snaking around into Harcourt Street, and there was only three hatches dealing with this. So it had gone from something like 12,500 applicants for registration in 10 years to about 135,000.
Right.
So the state didn't have the capability to deal with that. Ireland had become a country of immigration. We traditionally had exported people looking for new opportunities and a better life, left the state. As he said himself, when he was working in Ballsbridge, he used to see the queues snaking around the American embassy for people
leaving.
Trying to leave the state. And so that had turned on his head. And Ireland is now a modern, wealthy state that people from elsewhere are seeking a better life and better opportunities.
And what did he make then of recent times when we had polarised views, protests and so on with regard to immigration, all fuelled, of course, on social media? What did he think of all that?
Well, you have encapsulated it there. It's the ease with which this can be exploited in social media now is what marks it out. The information, disinformation and misinformation. He describes it as being misunderstood as a matter of race. This is a matter of people trying to better themselves. The vast majority of people who come here are coming here, as Irish people did for many years, going abroad, seeking, you know, a better life for their families, greater opportunities and financial and social security. And so, yeah, of course, it is the responsibility of the state to secure its borders. Of course, they have to make sure that people coming in are coming in for the right reasons. And so we need the legislation, we need the facilities, we need the infrastructure in place. And very importantly, as I said, the legislation in place, so effective legislation. But this is being exploited by people. And it's much easier to exploit these days, exploit people's emotions through social media. It's very easily done. And there are people who are doing it for nefarious reasons. Mm-hmm. And so, yes, he very much was looking at that askance. As he said, red flags are flying for democracy. It's very important that we mind what we have and that we're careful about. People are careful about what they believe, what they read, how they get their news.
So let's move on then through his career, because in 2016, he became Assistant Guard the Commissioner, didn't he? And he had this long running quest, which you've touched on, to bring down the Kinahan organised crime group. So we had the US sanctions being imposed. He played a huge role in that, and that was unprecedented. Tell me a little bit about his role in that, because that takes you from policing to dealing with international organisations, Donal, on a scale that this state hasn't done before.
Again, going back to his time in Store Street, which he described as his happiest and most...
He loved that part of his career, didn't he?
Absolutely, absolutely. But in that, as he said, the strands that went through his career, in that they had, in particularly in the case of Derek Dunn, had a huge amount of cooperation with authorities from abroad, and in the UK in particular. In the course of his career in GNIB, he had huge. He was involved. He travelled throughout Europe, and so he really understood that we can't fight this in isolation. We really, really need to cooperate with our international partners. The Kinahan organization is international. It's transnational. It's vast in scale, and it operates from outside the grasp of the state in places like Dubai and Spain, wherever it could before. And so we can only, and he saw that we can only tackle these within cooperation with the other authorities. So there was a huge amount of cooperation with the Spanish authorities in relation to drug dealing and drug dealers operating from Spain. And now, as you see, he describes in the book that there was still a warrant outstanding, international arrest warrant outstanding for Sean McGovern, and that there was no extradition treaty with the United Arab Emirates. Now, this book was only just finished, and we can see that Sean McGovern is now in custody in Dubai, and the minister recently went to the UAE where she signed...
To sign the extradition agreement.
Now, it remains to be seen what happens in those cases. But this was, as he saw, the essence of how we were going to... If these people are, you know, dealing with drugs in Ireland and elsewhere from abroad with impunity, you must cooperate with international partners. He was very good at that. He saw the value of it. And as you can see, it truly is having, sadly, after his demise and after he's gone, some of it's coming to...
But you must have been very proud, Donal. His family must have been very proud when the minister paid tribute to him when that extradition agreement was being signed.
Oh, absolutely. It was a huge moment. It was so close to his passing. We had spoken about it only days before, the two of us, just in terms of, you know, his huge optimism for what was coming, huge optimism about the future of policing and the future of Irish society and the people that he had worked with and the people and Garry Síochána who continue to police Ireland effectively. Many of the people who are at senior rank now are people that he worked with and very capable people and very determined people. And as he described himself, he said, you know, when you leave the house, it doesn't fall down because you built it with other people. So, you know, he would have been extremely proud. We could see that this was the fruition of work that he, things that he'd worked on for years. So, yeah, we were extremely proud to see that. It was a very proud moment.
He says that lovely thing towards the end of the book where he uses Larry Dunn's words.
Yeah.
And people will remember, you know, the misery that Larry Dunn and his family inflicted on people in the inner city in Dublin. And he said, if you think we're bad, you should see what's coming next. Now tell people what John said in response.
Yeah, well, John turned that on its head. And as he said, as I said, he was hugely optimistic about the future. And what he said was, as I said, it was very ominous and very threatening what Larry Dunn said. What John says of himself and of the people he worked with, says, if you think I'm good, wait and see what's coming next.
Mm-hmm. In terms of policing.
Oh, absolutely. Mm-hmm. You know, as I said, you know, he left behind a legacy. He had a huge effect. He was an exceptional police officer. He wanted to make a difference, and I think he made a difference, and I think that's plain to see that he made a difference. And so we're certainly very proud of the career that he had and of the service he gave.
I asked you when you came in there, did you ever work together? And I understand that you worked, you know, very separately, but you were telling me you did walk the beat one time.
We did walk the beat. I went in a very different direction. I worked in security and intelligence and special tactics and operations for years afterwards. And so there was crossover, particularly towards the end. We did. We had a sergeant who was a very witty man who thought nothing better than to annoy the both of us by sending us on the beat one night together. And I wore my biggest heels. I was taller than John, so I wanted to sort of lord it over him a bit, walking the beat. He didn't like it. We were sent out for about 3 hours together, and I think about an hour later I was back in the station with a prisoner, so it didn't last long. Yeah, so it was a good, healthy relationship, yeah.
Well, Donal, I really appreciate you coming in. It probably wasn't easy to do that when it's so recent, but it's a lovely tribute to John. And the book is out now. It's a fascinating read, Reflections on a Life in the Guards. It's On Duty by John O'Driscoll. And we think today about Muriel, as you said, and yeah, Michelle and Laura and Sean and all of the family. Thank you so much, Donal, for being with us. We'll take a break.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.